You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda, your co-host, now back in D.C. Good to be back.
Good to have you back, Ankit. Well, it was a big week for China, which hosted a Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit at the beginning of the week in Tianjin, and then held a massive military parade in Beijing to mark the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II in the Pacific. These events captured considerable global attention as dozens of world leaders flocked to China to attend, including Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. To help us dissect these developments, we're really happy to welcome back to the podcast Shannon Tiezi, the Diplomat's editor-in-chief and resident China expert. Welcome, Shannon.
Always good to join you, Katie and Ankit.
Great. Well, Shannon, since you're our guest star today, I'll start with you. You know, I'm curious about the overall optics of this week. What did these events symbolize for China? What was Beijing trying to communicate? And what were you watching most closely?
Yeah, so there was a lot of discussion about what the Tianjin summit meant for the SCO and how the SCO is important. To me, that's not what this was about. This was not about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. This was about China and China's convening power. And that's really what was on display this week, was China's ability to gather for both events over two dozen foreign leaders. And there was a lot of overlap, but there were also some people who only attended the SCO summit, most notably India's Narendra Modi, and some people who only attended the military parade, North Korea's Kim Jong-un being one of them. But these two events held back-to-back demonstrated China's ability to have high-level foreign dignitaries flock to its major cities, basically upon request. So it kind of, if you think about the way a G7 summit functions, the G7 summit is one thing and what's discussed and what's agreed upon between the members, but a lot of the action is on the sidelines. It's mm-hmm. the bilateral meetings between the host and the guests and between the various guests and the trilaterals and the different configurations that are going on. So for me, that was the really interesting part, was, you know, for the military parade specifically, China had 26 foreign leaders who came and stood on the dais at Tiananmen and watched this, you know, massive demonstration of China's military prowess march along beneath them. And symbolically, that's pretty significant, right? And I'm sure our guests have seen the photos of you had Xi Jinping, and then next to him on one side, Vladimir Putin, next to him on the other side, Kim Jong-un. And that became kind of one of the defining images of the summit, especially that you had Kim and Xi and Putin all next to each other. In terms of the actual content of the parade, it was really about what we've seen before, which is China trying to claim the role that it's the true inheritor and defender of the post-war international order. Xi's speech was pretty brief, especially compared to the previous anniversary parade in 2015 at the 70th anniversary. It was a short speech. There wasn't a lot in it. But what there was a lot of invocations to China claiming the moral high ground for itself. There was a focus on justice that, you know, if you're not paying close attention, might seem to echo the usual U.S. language about human rights. A lot of ideology and values were in Xi's speech, but he's not talking about human rights. He never says the word human rights. He's talking about the rights that belong to governments. His emphasis on fairness and justice is very much elevating the role of the global South, which is basically all of the people around Xi, right? He didn't have G7 members attending this parade. You didn't have Japan's prime minister, Korea's president. The developed countries were not represented at this parade. This is a global South event. And so she's claiming the mantle that he, on behalf of the global South, is fighting for fairness and justice and the true legacy of World War II. But, you know, this was also a military parade. I am not a military tech junkie, but I know that Ankit, our intrepid longtime Asia Geopolitics host, follows that very closely. So I'm curious to know what Ankit has to say about what was actually on display on this parade. While I was watching the leaders, presumably you were watching, you know, the tanks and the drones that were going by.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, really interesting. You know, it's always exciting for those of us who like to study the military capabilities of various countries to look at these kinds of parades. You know, I spend a lot of time watching parades in North Korea, China, and elsewhere. So it's always a kind of interesting moment to see what is shown, because there is a message obviously being sent with these parades to the outside world. So the way I would kind of maybe wrap it up, Shannon, and like maybe put a bow on everything, is that I think this was really the parade that speaks to what Chinese strategists call intelligentized warfare, right? Networked, modern 21st century capabilities, laser weapons, drones. This is the first parade since the PLA disbanded the Strategic Support Force, which was created in 2015, which Xi's last reorganization of the PLA. And this was the first one to feature the three new services that have come out of that Strategic Support Force: the Aerospace Force, which is the world's second independent space force after the U.S. Space Force, the Cyberspace Force, and the Information Support Force. So you saw a lot of those capabilities and units included in the parade. A lot of the more kind of futuristic looking drones had actually appeared in the 2019 parade. Some of them made a reappearance at this parade, but we did also see many new capabilities. And then finally, just to kind of put a flag on it, because, you know, I have a special interest in nuclear capabilities, the parade culminated with the demonstration of so-called strategic strike capability, so China's big nuclear-capable missile systems. And there was one capability here that really, really was interesting that I actually don't think a lot of the international press really picked up on the significance of this, but they paraded a missile called the DF-31BJ, the J being the letter that really drew my eye, because that is the Chinese, the romanization of the Chinese character for silo. You know, China's been undertaking this big nuclear buildup that's not officially acknowledged. Xi Jinping didn't talk about it or anything. It's still officially unacknowledged. But that vehicle is designed to actually load those new silos that are being built. So in a strange roundabout way, it was perhaps a bit of evidence that China is coming a little closer to becoming more transparent about what's going on with the nuclear buildup, because the choice to show that system at a parade is very much a deliberate one. They really didn't have to do that, because the DF-31 has other launchers that are road mobile launchers, and they chose to parade the silo loader instead, which I think is certainly a signal. So I'll stop there, and we could, you know, pull on any of those threads.
All right. Awesome. You know, I am curious, Shannon, when you're sort of thinking about the military hardware and thinking about like the optics of the conversations around who was at this parade, you know, what are you looking for next? You know, I think there's always a lot of discussion about what all of this military hardware means for, say, Taiwan or some of the other large hotspots. What are you looking at next when it comes to China, now that it has sort of placed this mantle on itself of leading the global south?
Yeah, so a lot of what happened at the parade was not really new. It was more a continuation of existing trends. So I think that's true in the military hardware front, as Ankit pointed out. It's also true in kind of the geopolitical symbolism front. It's not new that China is trying to put together a coalition of the global south with itself as more or less the unchallenged leader. That is a position China would very much like to have. And saying, we are fighting for justice and a fairer multipolar world order, which essentially is one where the U.S. has less say and China and Russia and these other countries have more of a say. So, you know, that signaling wasn't new in terms of like the meetings between Xi and foreign leaders. I think the one that attracted the most attention was Kim Jong-un. And I think there's a very good reason for that, which this is the first time that Kim has visited China in 5 years. You know, Putin's been to China almost every year. There's always interesting tidbits and you can tease apart their statements. But Kim hasn't been here. And North Korea's geopolitical positioning has changed dramatically since the last time that Kim Jong-un was in Beijing. Previously, he was still, you know, in the whole kind of warm and fuzzy moment where he had one summit with Trump. It was before the Hanoi summit with Trump. There were all these good vibes going on. You know, are the U.S. and North Korea going to reach a breakthrough? Is denuclearization actually possible? That's not on the table anymore. There's no signs of any U.S.-North Korea nuclear talks happening. Kim Jong-un has flat out rejected the possibility of any rapprochement with South Korea, even under the new administration. And instead, North Korea and Russia now have a security treaty, and North Korea is more or less openly supplying Russia with troops and ammunition for its war in Ukraine. So the vibe is just completely different. And so that meeting, I think, was the most interesting. And what caught my eye was a line that no matter how the international landscape may evolve, the China-North Korea partnership will stay unchanged, which is very similar to the language that China uses to talk about its relationship with Russia, which is basically a signal to the U.S. and the rest of the world, we're pursuing this partnership for strategic reasons of our own, and there's nothing you can do about it. So it seems like China is finally ready to turn over a new leaf in its relationship with North Korea. There's also an interesting line about North Korea supporting all these global, you know, Global X initiatives. China has a bunch of these now, the new Global Governance Initiative that was just announced, the Global Development Initiative, the Global Security Initiative. North Korea has not been allowed to join any of these. There are lots of reports that North Korea wanted to sign up, for example, to the Belt and Road Initiative. They wanted to get some of that sweet, sweet infrastructure funding that China was handing out like it was candy back around 2016. China wasn't interested. It was like they didn't want their precious global government initiatives tainted by association with North Korea, which is kind of this pariah state. Apparently, that's not the case anymore. China is now openly saying, hey, North Korea signed on to our global initiatives. Isn't that great? So I think we might see a new era in China-North Korea cooperation, probably on the economic front more than anything else, because that's really what North Korea wants from China. They can get their security cooperation from Russia. So that's what I'm going to be watching for going forward, is what are the concrete moves in China-North Korea relations? Because out of all the sideline meetings that were happening, I think that one was the most significant.
Yeah, absolutely. Ankit, as our resident North Korea hand, you know, what is your perspective on that developing North Korea-China relationship and sort of what we saw within the context of these larger events?
Yeah, no, I think Shannon really kind of, you know, described it really well. I think for Kim Jong-un, I mean, this is entirely consistent with, I think, his longstanding strategic objectives. I mean, you know, the other thing that really caught my eye is it's just remarkable to see Kim Jong-un at an event like this with 20 plus world leaders. He's never done that, right? He is always, the moment he started traveling abroad in 2018 with his first trip to Beijing, he has only met kind of one-on-one, and then he met Moon Jae-in and Donald Trump together in June 2019 for that last meeting at the Panmunjom inter-Korean joint security area on the inter-Korean border. So for him to travel to Beijing in this setting and to stand right beside Xi and Putin is just a really remarkable way to signal his kind of role as a global statesman, which is something he's been trying to very much cultivate since that initial bout of summitry in 2018 and 2019. And I actually went back and I looked at, you know, last time a North Korean leader attended a major parade like this with multiple leaders, it was his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, 1959. Pretty hard to find pictures from then, but I tried to see how was Kim Il-sung treated at the time. He was not standing next to Mao, right? It was Mao and Khrushchev and Ho Chi Minh and then Zhou Enlai. And then I think, I forget who, there was somebody else and then Kim Il-sung, you know? So Kim Jong-un is really, I think, received the kind of welcome in Beijing here that he probably always wanted. I mean, and then I think Shannon's especially, you know, on the money about China now playing this role in normalizing North Korea, right? I think that's a big part of the story in this new geopolitical context. The Russians have been very explicit. They're basically, you know, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has said on multiple occasions that Russia's basically closed the chapter on the denuclearization era, that Russia is no longer really that interested in the fact that North Korea left the non-proliferation treaty, is under UN Security Council resolutions over its nuclear programs. What's interesting from China's perspective is that, you know, China has a different approach to talking about that issue, right? They still support denuclearization. If you read kind of what comes out of the foreign ministry press conferences on the Korean Peninsula, it's really about, you know, the same old denuclearization, supporting UN Security Council resolutions. Yeah. But this choice with the leaders themselves, I mean, North Korea endorsing these new, you know, Chinese initiatives, I think it really is, you know, we are at the doorstep of a fundamentally different period. So basically a longer way of agreeing with what Shannon said. And for Kim Jong-un, you know, the fact that he also brought his daughter, I think, is just a very, very interesting choice here about just the signaling on planning for a potential succession scenario. Again, the big wild card with North Korea is we all know Kim Jong-un is not a paragon of health. We just don't know how unhealthy he might really be. And a premature death in a nuclear-armed neighbor is something that I'm sure the Chinese actually have quite a sharp interest in, as they did with previous North Korean successions as well. So I think meeting the daughter, whose name we think is Ju-ae, the North Koreans have never actually told her that that's her name. But
They told Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, told Dennis Rodman, exactly. And I don't know if Dennis Rodman's the most reliable narrator, but there you go. I'm sure that was deeply of interest as well to the Chinese.
Yeah, speaking of the seating arrangements, one thing I found very interesting was that you had Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un, and then Kazakhstan's president, Tokayev. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by this, not just because they put him next to Kim Jong-un, but because that meant they didn't put him next to Vladimir Putin, because they could easily have done that, right? You want him to be two seats away from Xi Jinping. Well, you could have gone Xi, Putin, Tokayev, but they didn't. So, Katie, I would love to get your thoughts on the Central Asian president's role here. We haven't seen much discussion of that, kind of par for the course from Central Asia. So I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah. No, that picture was interesting to me, too, maybe for another reason. I believe on the other side of Putin was the Uzbek president. And so, you know, I think they got sort of the next poll positions. I don't really know what goes into the seating arrangements. But I do think putting Tokayev next to Kim is interesting for a number of reasons. You know, Kazakhstan is very proud about the fact that it gave up its nuclear arsenal that was left in the country when the Soviet Union collapsed, and is very big in the non-proliferation space. And so it's a really interesting sort of putting those two next to each other in that the nuclear question area. But also Kazakhstan is pursuing nuclear energy, nuclear power, particularly with China and with Russia. Russia got the first contract for Kazakhstan's first nuclear power plant. China got the next two. And there's been reporting that they anticipate the two and three to happen before one, because Russia is a little bit busy right now. So there is some really interesting sort of stuff even on the nuclear angle there. But for Central Asia, you know, you hit the nail on the head. It's not a region that is usually paid attention to in the global sort of geopolitical sphere. It is often sort of seen as very peripheral to these things. But it's pretty core. It's core to the SCO just by technicality, but it's also kind of core to this idea of the global south. All five Central Asian presidents went to the SCO summit, even the Turkmen president, who always comes as a guest, and they all moved on to go to Beijing. I think for me, what was maybe more important than the fact all five got bilateral meetings with Xi, most of them also had bilateral meetings with Putin. Kazakhstan's president and Uzbekistan's president in particular had a lot of meetings with Chinese business leaders, not just in the nuclear power space, but in several other sort of key industries. And so for Central Asia, events like this are a time when they are, you know, a respected member at the table in a way that they don't always get in the West. You know, when you have the Tajik president, maybe last year or the year before, went to Paris for a state visit, and, you know, the French rolled out the red carpet, there were protesters because it's France, it's the West, that's okay. There were no protesters in Beijing against any of these leaders. And I think they probably appreciate being able to go somewhere and be sort of an equal respected member of the international community in that forum. I do want to add also that this doesn't sort of forestall any of their relationships with the West. You know, on the same day, I think it was the same day as the parade or the day before, might have been between the SCO summit and the parade, news came out that the EU and Uzbekistan are finally going to sign their enhanced partnership and cooperation agreement. It's been in the works for many, many years, but they're, you know, Mirziyoyev is going to go to Brussels in late October and sign this document and sort of upgrade relations with the EU. And so there is this Central Asian states really have a very very crossroads mentality. You know, their foreign policies are often sort of phrased as being multi-vector. They're interested in dealing with whoever will deal with them, which sometimes can look a little duplicitous if you want to divide the world into blocks. But from their perspective, they're invited to everything and they will go to everything. And so there's a lot of value in that engagement for them. Mm-hmm. I guess, before we wrap this up, any final thoughts, Shannon or Ankit, on this sort of big week for China and where we think this is going next?
Well, I've got one. I mean, I just have to point out when we're talking about, like, you know, because this is kind of a big picture geopolitics podcast, like I just could not help the global optics this week, right? So you have... Mm-hmm. Xi Jinping, with all these leaders, looking at a whole bunch of really advanced military capabilities in Asia. The very same week, the United States is carrying out an unprecedented targeted killing of claimed narco-terrorists in the Caribbean, and so focused kind of internally and like on hemispheric affairs. So when we talk about kind of, you know, what role will the United States play, at least from the view of the second Trump administration, you really couldn't draw just, I think, a more sharp contrast. I mean, you know, Trump did have that post on Truth Social where he seemed jealous not to be invited and told the leaders to have fun, I believe, as they conspire against the United States. But yeah. But really, I mean, you know, you had a U.S. that was very much kind of not so focused on this, right? I mean, you could have had a completely different narrative here about, you know, Trump deciding to push back on, you know, China trying to make some kind of case for military primacy in the Indo-Pacific or anything in a different era. I mean, even under the first Trump administration, I think you would have seen that. So just geopolitically, I mean, I think that's another piece of the optics in global affairs this week that just strikes me as potentially indicative of some pretty big changes.
Yeah, I think it was wild a couple of months ago. There was actually a rumor that Trump might attend the military parade. He's made several comments that make it seem like he's angling for an invitation to Beijing because they literally treated him like an emperor last time, you know, private dinner in the Forbidden City, which had never happened before. They rolled out the red carpet plus, and, you know, Trump really likes that sort of thing. So he clearly wanted to go back, I think, not for any geopolitical reasons, but just because he had a great time.
Yeah.
And I think, like Ankit said, he was a little disappointed. So it's wild to think that we might have had Trump sitting up there with Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin with no like real geopolitical import behind it, just that the dude
just
likes
a great
party.
Yeah, just a great party, exactly.
He likes a parade,
so that,
you know?
That. Sometimes it's not all the geopolitics, it's, you know, the after party.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and to sort of end on that note, Ankit and I have discussed this in other podcasts, sort of Trump's style very much bleeds into a lot of these things and make sort of our impulse to analyze sort of the geopolitical positioning sometimes falls by the wayside because there's a lot of personality being injected into the decision making process. And as you pointed out, the United States is very sort of or as Ankit pointed out, the United States is very inwardly focused right now and is very hemispheric in its sort of area. And honestly, maybe that'll work to China and Russia's preferences, you know, in terms of spheres of influence. You know, is that the world we're going back to? We will have to see. Going to have to put a pin in it for now, but we will certainly be back. Thanks for listening to the Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics podcast. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe to our podcast wherever it is that you're listening so you don't miss out on future episodes. Remember, you can also get in touch with Ankit and myself with episodes, suggestions, or questions. We'll be back soon with more. Thanks, everybody.